There's a lot of things going on in the world right now that can make thinking about being happy difficult, but we can find wisdom about how to deal with today's world from ancient Jewish practices, says Rabbi Evan Moffick.
Nobody has really explored the depth of the relationship between spirituality and happiness, and I hope that people can begin to embrace it, and that my ultimate goal is that religion and faith can be a source of good and joy for people rather than a source of division.
His new book is called The Happiness Prayer. Plus, it's the unofficial end of summer with children all across Illinois back in school. We talked to an expert about one of the most important things to have students ready for learning, sleep.
Without adequate sleep, we can't pay attention. There are difficulties with memory, learning, and performance.
And when Bloomington School District tells us how it's gone, now that they've adjusted school start times to be later for older students. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It might be hard to think about happiness these days, given all that's going on in our country and the world. But Highland Park Rabbi Evan Moffick makes the case that it's the way we understand happiness that's the problem. His latest book is called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. It goes back to ancient Judaic traditions, including one particular prayer that he's used as a spiritual exercise for years. It's part of a happiness curriculum he developed at his temple, Congregation Salal, in Chicago's north suburbs, and it comes out next week. If you're in the Chicago area, Rabbi Moffick has an event next Thursday at the Standard Club. We'll tweet out more details for that. He's in studio with me here in downtown Chicago, Rabbi Moffick. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks, Nyla. It's wonderful to see you and to be with you again.
In one sense, I think a lot of people would say there's not much to be happy about these days. I think the last time you were on the 21st, we were talking about refugees being shut out of America.
Yes.
And our moral obligation to bring them in. We're in a country where 1,000 or so neo-Nazis feel comfortable walking on our streets. We just saw and are experiencing what may be the most expensive natural disaster and dozens of deaths in Texas from Harvey. This is a tough time, I think, to be talking about happiness, or at least how we understand it, don't you think?
Tremendously. And I think we look around us and we see so much pain and agony, and it makes us think, what is there to be happy about? But I think that's actually part of the challenge, what's happening shows us the need for intentional pursuit of happiness. I mean, one of the things you mentioned, the storm terror in Houston, and I'm kind of like, you know, a lot of happiness is genetic. We can get into this, you know, about 50% of our general outlook comes from how we're born. So I'm genetically predispossessed to be
pretty, you and I are pretty genetically pretty happy people.
Which is great. But that being said, I have seen amazing examples in Texas of people with these extraordinary acts of kindness that actually make us happier. You talk to the people who've helped rescue. You talk to the people that have seen people come together to rescue others, and they feel uplifted and inspired. And that's part of the journey to happiness.
Well, and to your point, I think part of this is also an understanding, right? I think there's a very American way that we understand happiness that you think is actually pretty contrary to ancient Judaic traditions of understanding happiness.
Absolutely. I think it's this ancient tradition is countercultural in some ways. We tend to associate, in our consumerist society, we associate happiness with possession. The more things you have, the happier you are. Remember, there's that old bumper sticker, he who dies with the most toys wins, right? So there's this feeling that the more you get, the more status you have, the happier you are. And it's really, I mean, most people understand intuitively that that's wrong, but we have to intentionally pursue a way of life that makes us happier.
And so when you say we have to intentionally do it, you do mean a practice, you do mean an exercise, you do mean this is something we have to think about and develop.
Yes, I think it makes it a lot easier. So look at the word happiness itself. The root is hap, same root as in happenstance, it happened to me. In some ways, it's outside of our control. So this idea of happiness is that it's just something we kind of luck into. But the Jewish idea of happiness, and when I say Jewish, I also mean the biblical idea. I mean, this is part of the way the Old Testament understands it, is that happiness is simcha, which is a Hebrew word meaning joy. It's something we can intentionally pursue. So if we follow these practices in the book, gratitude, acts of kindness, hospitality, then we will be happier in the long run.
So you said 50% of this is genetic.
Yeah.
You start the book by talking about how some people are naturally happy. As we've noted, both of us,
yes.
you and I, are both naturally pretty optimistic people.
Yes.
But you went through a period in your life where you realized, wow, life is really hard for me right now. I'm not sure I can be happy. Can you tell me about that?
Absolutely. I think we all go through that at one point or another. You know, the book of Ecclesiastes says, time and chance befall us all. So I think we all go through difficult experiences. Some go through it very early in life. Some have come from broken families and they see parents having difficulties when they're 3, 4, they begin to experience that. Other people, it comes later. But I do think we all go through, some call it the dark night of the soul, or just difficult circumstances. So to me, it happened when I, out of a wonderful achievement, at 30 years old, I became the head rabbi of a wonderful congregation where I still serve in the suburbs of Chicago. And I was just totally overwhelmed. I was a new father it was not the easiest of pregnancies and deliveries. And we just had so much happening. And then people were turning to me with enormous problems that I didn't feel equipped to handle. And I kind of went into this.
But you're the rabbi, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm supposed to have all the answers.
Adds to the stress, right?
Exactly. I mean, I followed a rabbi who had been there for 25 years. He was 68 years old and he retired, a wonderful, wise, smart person. And then here I am, this 30-year-old, like, yeah, sure, I know the answer. But I didn't. And part of my experience was coming to terms with that, was accepting that, but also trying to draw from the wisdom that I did have and the life experience I did have, and getting, you know, it was a sort of a personal journey to getting in touch with my own emotions and my own sensitivities and needs and desires. And that was a great journey. It was a tough journey, but I would do it again. Absolutely.
So part of that journey, you talk about how your father introduced you to Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes.
Well, can you explain how and when you first encountered Viktor Frankl and sort of what role that played in all of this?
So it's actually a two-part story. So when I was in college, I remember reading it for a class. But I read it and they said, okay, interesting stuff, meaning, great. But somehow, you know, my dad's a psychiatrist, and he mentioned it to me as I was struggling. I saw that, you know, people, especially in Chicago where you know, you have so many resources, people can go to see therapists for mental health issues. People can go to see, you know, trainers for physical issues. But people turn to clergy for meaning issues. What is my life about? What am I here for? And that's where clergy kind of are the real guides. And then, so the importance of meaning came back to me. That came to say, okay, I need to help guide people to what a meaningful life is. I may not be able to help them understand, you know, addictions. You know, I had people who came to me because their children had serious drug addictions. I may not be able to help them understand where that comes from, but I can help them understand the meaning of their parenthood, of their children's life, and of the journey they're going through.
You mentioned your father being a psychiatrist. I want to ask about the sort of the role of faith and religion in all of this, right? Because there are, and it's very interesting throughout the book, you make an interesting distinction between faith and religion.
Yes.
Why do you make that distinction?
For a couple of reasons. First, I think, first of all, religion often has a negative vibe to it these days, unfortunately. People think religion, people think rules and strictures, and this is what you can't do. And people sometimes associate faith with a positive spin. So I think sometimes we need to clear out that distinction. But I do think every religion is an expression of a deeper faith. But we need those systems. Here's sort of one of the analogies I like to think about. There are hundreds of different kinds of soups, right? They all share a base quality that they're soup, they're liquid, they're hot usually. Well, there's cold soups, but they're usually hot. But then there are different varieties of soups. You can't go into a restaurant and just say, I'd like some soup. You know, maybe they'll bring you broth or something, but usually you'd got, I'll have split pea or I'll have tomato. And that's what makes it meaningful. So I think the same is true with faith. We need particular religions to guide us into a community and set of practices for that faith. But this book and my own, this prayer actually, I think, is universal enough to work with people of different religions.
And I guess my question is would you say, and I think it's interesting in the book, you have a lot of research that talks about how meditation or other prayer, other quote-unquote religious things, right, have been shown to have tangible physical benefits to people's health. Is that part of what I imagine you're trying to anticipate skeptics who are saying, I don't need this?
Absolutely. It's amazing. And this is actually one of the reasons I wrote the book is a lot of scholars, there's this whole field of positive psychology, which really started out of the University of Pennsylvania, a guy named Martin Seligman, who I have been in touch with. It was beginning to study what makes for a happier life, a life of flourishing, a life of well-being. And they applied rigorous scientific studies to this question. A part of it was psychology had so long focused on what's wrong with people. And Martin Seligman and colleagues said, let's focus on what's right with people, what practices make us happier, not just what, you know, makes us less miserable. So they studied this. And one of their findings was that spirituality, a sense of deeper purpose and reason for being in the universe, was a tremendous predictor of happiness. But they didn't go too far into exploring why, because academia shies away from religion, especially at a place like Penn, a secular university. They didn't want to go too far into it. So there's a lot of exploration that needs to be done, and I felt part of my job was to do that.
I'm speaking with Rabbi Evan Moffick. His latest book is called, it's out next week. The book's called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. And so, Rabbi Moffick, what would you say to people who would say, well, maybe people who are predisposed to religion or people who are predisposed to be happy? Would you say that that's, in your experience, I'm thinking in particular of your congregation, would you say that's true?
No, I would say, I'd say most people are predisposed to some sort of religion. I'm a believer. There's a guy who wrote a book called The God, DNA, something like that. DNA and God were both in the title. But it talked about how we are in some ways programmed to seek some kind of higher power. So I do think we're
predisposed. The God gene, is that it?
The God gene, that's it. And so I do think we are inclined towards that. So I think religion can appeal to everybody, but I do think that the practices that religion tends to encourage, community, prayer, looking at our life from a higher perspective, those make us happier.
So I want to get into those principles in just a minute, but I want to ask you first how you would define faith.
That's a great question and something I go back and forth, but I think in some ways faith is self-transcendence. That we are not everything that is in the universe, that everything in the universe can't be defined by genes, by DNA, by chemicals, that there's something bigger than ourselves that we live as part of. And not everything can be seen and understood. You know, I believe faith doesn't ask us to turn off our brains, but I also think what we see, what we can understand and experience in the universe isn't all that there is. My kind of favorite author on this is Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's a great rabbi who talked about radical amazement and wonder, and that wonder is the source of faith, the ability to sort of intuit and imagine that there's more. It's actually in Shakespeare, there's more to life, there's more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in your philosophy, that there's much more out there than we totally understand.
And you think that's something that we probably tend to lose sight of?
Yeah, I think especially today. I think we live in a world where so much is, you know, driven by information and digits and what we can totally grasp. But I think all of us, I think every person in life goes through moments where they do intuit that there's something bigger than themselves. It could be when they go through a crisis. It could be the birth of a child or a time of healing. I think we all experience that. And then this goes back to a great question you asked earlier, the difference between faith and religion. Faith can be sporadic. It can happen in moments. Religion sort of concretizes those experiences. It gives us a framework for living a life that allows us to, in a sense, put foundations under those experiences. Every person will have these spiritual moments, but religion gives us a structure for experience that transcendence in our daily lives.
That said, why did you or where did you come to developing this happiness curriculum for your temple?
well, these practices just made sense to me. You know, a lot of the great work in positive psychology has not translated into concrete acts. You know, they know kindness is good, gratitude is good, generosity is good. And one of the beautiful things about religion is that religion, especially Judaism, is about deeds. It's about what you do in your daily lives. So I kind of thought this can be a bridge between the academic findings of positive psychology and the daily lives of my congregation. And I'm sort of in the trenches, right? Every pulpit, every member of the clergy who is serving a congregation is in the trenches. You are there with people in their darkest moments and their most joyous moments. So I thought, here's in some ways some value I can add in my role as a rabbi and as someone who understands positive psychology.
That's Rabbi Evan Moffick. He's the author of The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. The book's actually coming out next week. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with him about this curriculum that he's developed. It's all in this book. It's something that he practices with his congregation, Solal, that's in the Chicago's north suburbs in Highland Park. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. As a reminder, we love hearing feedback from you. You can always get in touch with us. Leave us a voicemail. Send us an email. All of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. That's where you can leave us a voicemail, send us an email, give us feedback. We'd love to hear from you. If you follow us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. And if you follow our Twitter handle, that's our Twitter handle is 21stshow. That's 21st show. During the program, we live tweet with more background and context analysis on what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Our handle is 21st show. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about happiness. My guest is Chicago area Rabbi Evan Moffick. His newest book is called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. It's actually coming out next week. He's in studio with me here in Chicago talking about this happiness curriculum that he developed. So there's a couple essential ingredients, right?
Yes.
Rabbi Moffick. Let's start, though, with gratitude, because you think that's a key. Why do you feel like we have to start with gratitude in order to develop or cultivate an attitude of happiness?
Well, I think gratitude is a way of focusing the brain. In many ways, the study of positive psychology is, and in religion generally, is being upended because of brain science. And what we focus on shapes how we feel, right? We can focus on something positive and we feel better. When we focus on gratitude, when we focus on being thankful for what we have, we are less likely to think about what we don't have. So it really just is a way of focusing the brain. And Martin Seligman did these incredible studies. People who wrote down every day three things they're grateful for. And in fact, I have a something. If you order the book, I can send it to you. Just you can send me an email and I will send you a chart that is a way of writing down three things a day that we are grateful for. And if you do that consistently, you will be 40% happier. This happens over 4 weeks. It happens over 8 weeks. It happens over 16 weeks. It's one of the most extraordinary studies. So it refocuses the brain.
Is that something that you do?
Absolutely. I typically do it in the morning. A lot of people do it at night. But I have a whole routine when I wake up in the morning and I write, you know, what am I grateful for from yesterday? And, you know, it helps me recount the day and it also puts me in a positive frame of mind.
Is this something that you do with your kids as well?
I try to when I put them to sleep. I should be doing it more, but I do think it's important. And we do it especially on the Jewish Sabbath. We talk about what we're grateful for the week. So we do it. We can always do a better job.
But it's interesting, I imagine, when you do this with kids, right? Because you get to sort of learn their personality. You get to learn the things that they're grateful for. And it also, I imagine, helps cultivate a habit in children too.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's the thing about gratitude is, in some ways it's natural, but in other ways it's not natural. One of the things I uncovered in the research for this book, we see 3,000 advertisements a day, minimal. And this is like cars passing on the road, you know, the ads that come up before YouTubes. People are constantly trying to get us to want things, to cultivate desires. And that's fine. I market things. We all market things. But it's not the route to happiness. You know, it's a route to doing things better, right? We can get more efficient phones and so forth. But if we focus only on what we don't have, we're going to be miserable.
And you were talking about kindness, too. And we were just thinking about tragedies like Hurricane and Tropical Storm Harvey and sort of the acts of kindness that we've seen there. Why do you think that being kind or acts of kindness are really important? Because that's, you know, you said in the Jewish tradition, there is a lot of focus on deeds. Why do you think that is an important thing to do?
That's my favorite chapter of the whole book, is the book on kindness. And that, to me personally, is what I've been working on. See, one of the things I talk about in the book, there are 10 different practices. And unless you're a saint, you're not going to be able to do all 10 all the time.
Right, like visiting the sick in the hospital. There's a whole chapter on how you visit sick people, and that makes us uncomfortable. That's probably not something all of us agree. That's your job to do that.
That's my job, yes. Yes, but we can't do all of them. We have to discern in life moments where we can do more of them, right? If we're raising kids, we're not going to have as much time to honor our own parents. But maybe when we're older and our kids are at home, we have more time. So we have to discern what works for us at these moments in our lives. For me right now, kindness is very important. I think so many of the divisions in our country today can be overcome when we are kind to one another. I don't want it to make it sound like kindness is always easy. It's not. One of the people that I read as I wrote this chapter was a psychologist named Adam Phillips. And he wrote a book about kindness where he talks about we should be more kind. We would be happier. Most people are much happier when they do something kind for another person. Let's say they put coins in a meter for somebody else, or they hold the door open, or just, you know, buy somebody a meal. We feel happier, but we don't do it nearly as much. And part of it is because it exposes us to vulnerability. What if we're rejected? What if that person doesn't appreciate it? So we are not as kind as we could be because it exposes us to feelings. And if we can overcome that and we can be kinder, we'll be happier.
Well, you also talk about how we need to be kind within existing relationships we have, right? It's not just kindness to strangers. You have a long discussion about, you have a great story about a couple at your temple who, were they married for 75 years?
Yes. Oh, incredible couple.
And what was their lesson of kindness?
Well, they had a couple of good ones. They said, you know, one of the ones that the husband said was just say yes, dear, even if you don't understand what she's saying. But
we've heard that. That one we've heard. Right?
Yeah. But part of it was just listening to one another. You know, there's kindness glues couples together. There's a notion that whenever we start a conversation, it's a bid. So let's say somebody says, how was work today? Do you respond, oh, it was interesting. How was your day? Or do you say, ugh, it was terrible. I'm tired. I'm just going to go watch TV. One of them opens up the conversation. The other one closes it off. So opening the conversation leads to healthier relationships.
I'm speaking with Rabbi Evan Moffick. He's the author of a book called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today. So I love this idea that you have in the book where you talk about these practices are just also about being open and learning. And I love this idea of experimental innovators. Can you talk about that? Because I think there are people who might be listening thinking you can be open and you can innovate when you're young and that's when all of your creativity happens. But after 30, it's all downhill.
Oh, absolutely not. I think, and sometimes we think that, but I have seen so many people who are older who learn something new and are just tremendous. I was just talking yesterday, I bet she'll be listening later, to a member of my synagogue who was not very active in Jewish life earlier in her career, but she came back to it after she retired and has learned Hebrew, is active, and she is as happy as she can be. I mean, we can, especially if we have decent health, we can continue to grow and do more in older age. And I think as people live longer and are healthier, these are even more important. And we can always work on these qualities. I mean, I'm working on kindness, but still all the time. My wife jokes with me, we'll be in an argument or something, and then someone from the congregation will call on the phone, and I'll be like the nicest, sweetest, most kind person in the world. And she's like,
why aren't you doing that to me?
Exactly. So we can always grow and learn in this. And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of religion generally. We don't have to be perfect. God accepts us as we are. And it's a journey to becoming our best selves.
I wonder if you can explain a little bit about when you first encountered the prayer that is the inspiration for this book. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. It's been on my mind for a while. So this prayer is actually taken from the Talmud, which is a textbook of Jewish laws and teachings written, there's 66 volumes, but it's written 2,000 years ago. And this text is recited during a morning worship service. So kind of like in Jewish prayer, there are sections of the Psalms that are recited regularly. And this is a section of the Talmud that's recited regularly. So really, once I started studying positive psychology, it was like a lightning bolt. One morning, I was sitting in services, and the bat mitzvah was chanting this prayer, and I was looking and I said, wait a minute, gratitude, lifelong learning, kindness, I'm like, this is all what I've been studying and what I know leads to a happier life. So I just sort of connected the prayer that I had heard hundreds of times, I connected it to what I was studying, and the two came together.
So it's a pretty short prayer, right?
10 verses.
Can you tell us the name and tell us the prayer?
Yeah, it's called the Elu Devarim. And in Hebrew, it's Elu Devarim She'ein Lehem Shiur, Kibud Av Ve'Eim V'Gimilut Chasadim V'Chach Nasat Beit HaMidrash Shacharit V'Aravit. And it goes on, and there are 10 of them. So it's honor father and mother, acts of loving kindness, diligent pursuit of knowledge and wisdom, hospitality to wayfarers, visiting the sick, celebrating with bride and groom, accompanying the bereaved. And so I list all 10 of these. I translate the Hebrew in a broader way so people can understand the underlying purpose of each of the commandments, but there's 10 of them. The original title for the book was The Other 10 Commandments. My publisher wanted it to be a little more open. Sometimes the word commandments can throw people off, but I love that title.
You like The Other 10 Commandments. It's better than the notion of this prayer, which has become sort of a discipline, right?
Yes.
So it's an interesting notion, though, I think, that people tend to think. So that's a really interesting kind of marketing question, right? So
right.
The Other 10 Commandments gets to, I think, a lot of the ideas that religion and faith are rules that you have to follow.
Right.
I guess, but there is part of this where you're saying that it's this structure is something, making having an exercise, having it be a habit.
Yes.
There's a reason why spiritual exercises have the word exercise in it, right?
Yes. Spiritual practices or exercises, and that it's ongoing. And in many ways, I'm a person of faith. I'm a rabbi. So I do believe there are commandments that come from God. But not all people believe that, but I still think these practices are good for them. These practices work whether you believe they come from a commander or not. And that's partially why.
Or what faith tradition you come from.
Exactly. Exactly. It works. There was a famous scientist named Pasteur who said, I'm going to err on the side of faith. I don't know one or the other, but these work. It's kind of like, and this is a very Jewish thing in a way. In some ways, it doesn't always matter what you believe, it matters what you do. And these practices, whether you believe they come from God or whether you believe they're mandated by your religious tradition, they work in helping us live a happier life. So that's why the book is framed in the way it is, because I want people who aren't even religious at all, who they're looking to say, a rabbi, but even if they're not religious, they'll find this helpful. And nobody has really explored the depth of the relationship between spirituality and happiness. And I think there's a whole new field to explore, and I hope that people can begin to embrace it. And that religion, my ultimate goal is that religion and faith can be a source of good and joy for people rather than a source of division.
One of the important things we haven't really talked about, and we've kind of touched on it, is community. And I wanted to just ask you about what you think the role of community is in all of this, because we've talked about our individuality in terms of our individual spirituality, in terms of individual choices that we make, whether we're choosing to be kind to people, cultivating that. But what role does relationship and community play in this?
Huge. And that's another one of the great advantages of religious communities. There was a study done a couple years ago that said people who belong to a church or a synagogue, and I presume a mosque would fit as well, they live 7 years longer on average than people who don't. And I think one of the reasons for that is other people are looking out for them, and they have connections with other people. Social connections make us happier and healthier. And you don't have to be friends with everybody in the world, but we need a sort of core group of people.
Yeah, you have like you have actually a number. You have like 8 to 10,
yes.
Right? You call them the 2 a.m. people?
The 2 a.m. people.
And what is right. And that means?
These are the people who you could call at 2 a.m. and they'd answer the phone and be there for you, regardless of that it's 2 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, the truth is most of us don't have 8 or 10 of those outside of our family or a spouse or whatever. Most of us don't, especially men. You know, there's an interesting study that men generally have fewer of those than women, but we need them. And we need to be, I mean, I know this about myself, you know. I mean, I'm a rabbi, so I have a lot of great acquaintances, but, you know, these friendships of people who don't care what you do, they don't care what you do for them, they simply love you and cherish you for who you are. We need to be intentional in finding those kind of people.
I wanted to think about this. I'm thinking about the fact you write about this in the book that you preside over a lot of funerals.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what perspective that gives you. And you talk about this also, sort of a Jewish tradition of remembering the day someone died as
yes.
opposed to the day that they were born.
Mm, yes, because a birth is a potential. But when somebody passes away, you can look at their life as a whole. And there's something we can honor in a person who has lived life fully. And by living life fully, that doesn't mean you achieved everything you want to achieve or you were rich or successful or famous. It means you had meaningful relationships. And I see that over and over again. I mean, these funerals that I do, in some ways, are the best tutorials on how to live. I mean, I think about that all the time. It's the most important thing that I do because it really shows what matters in the end. And what ultimately matters are the relationships that we have and in the ways we've touched other people's lives.
And so I imagine it must be hard for you for funerals where maybe a lot of people don't show up.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I see that. I mean, the sad truth is, especially people who live a long time. I mean, I just officiated a funeral for an amazing, wonderful woman. She was 97 years old. So most of her friends had died already. So there weren't that many people, but this was a person who was just magnificent. So in some ways, if you live a very long life, it's harder to have a lot of people who come. But the truth is, it's the people who you touched and your children and grandchildren, the memories that they share, and the simple things. I mean, this may sound cliche-ish, but it's really true. Were you available for them? Were you around? Did you create happy memories? The memories could be as simple as, you know, playing catch or going for a walk, but those make a huge difference.
So I want to just end by asking, you write that all of life is a quest to return to the ancient wisdom we once knew by heart.
Well, that's a beautiful Jewish midrash. So midrash is Jewish interpretation of the biblical text. It's answering questions that are posed. And the midrash actually comes from, why do we have our Adam's apple? And so the rabbis asked this question, and they said, it's because right before we were born, all the wisdom, the Torah, that we had learned was plucked from us. Isn't that? It's a wonderful. But they were. So they
only
were,
men have yeah. an Adam's apple.
Well, that's
right
true. Well, yeah, okay. Okay. So the
so
biblical
the men had the wisdom plucked from them.
Yes.
I'd like to
women still
out.
Have that. Women okay. still have it. But the idea is, I think the deeper truth behind this is that much of our faith traditions, it's uncovering what we already know and what we're blocked from experiencing in life. You know, we know that love matters. We know that kindness it makes us happier. We know that community, you know, builds deeper relationships that we need. But we're pulled in so many different directions. So life is a journey to recovering that wisdom that we once had. It's built into us, but we have to get back to it. You know, T.S. Eliot has that great poem where he talks about to return to where we came from and to know that place for the first time. And I think that's kind of what the journey of Torah and learning and really the journey of happiness is. Because I think all of us, if you read this book, I'm not introducing any revolutionary new theory. In a way, I'm reminding people of what we already know and giving examples and insights on how to live in that way.
His book is called The Happiness Prayer, Ancient Jewish Wisdom for the Best Way to Live Today by Rabbi Evan Moffick. Thanks for being with me, Rabbi.
Thanks, Nyla. It's an honor and a joy to talk with you.
The The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. We know today's the day that pretty much marks the end of summer, and for families with children, that means getting into the back-to-school routine. Sometimes the hardest part can be getting kids to bed on time so they can get enough sleep and be alert and ready to do well for school the next day. Easier said than done, but still important. To help us learn more about the importance of a good night's rest for children of all ages, I'm joined now by Dr. Stephen Sheldon. He's the director of the Sleep Medicine Center at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago, where he also teaches pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Sheldon, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Sheldon, I know we can't say enough that sleep is important for people of all ages, but why is it, do you think, especially important for children to have an appropriate amount of sleep?
Well, sleep is important in just about every aspect of our lives. It's important to keep us awake and alert the next day. It is probably as important or more important than food in helping brain growth and development. Without adequate sleep, we can't pay attention. There are difficulties with memory, learning, and performance.
And is there a good rule of thumb to knowing how much sleep is enough for kids? Can we start with maybe elementary school age?
Well, there is a range of normal, and it's difficult to say exactly what's normal for each individual child. But on average, the National Sleep Foundation shows that during elementary school years, about 9 to 10 hours of sleep is probably appropriate.
And what about for teenagers?
Teenagers actually need more sleep than the younger children. Their total sleep time typically should be around 9 hours a night, yet their social pressures and educational activities require them to do a lot in the evening. And they spend actually less time in bed and are, for the most part, very sleep deprived.
Right. I want to get to the sleep deprived of both of teenagers in a minute, but let me go back to what you said about 8 to 10 hours for elementary school age and every child being different. How do you think parents can tell whether or not their children are truly well rested or not, especially coming off of the summer? Do you think that summer is normally a good time for parents to kind of figure out this is how much sleep my child really needs?
Actually, the best way is to determine how the youngster is doing during the daytime. If the child is wide awake and alert, has no problems with overactivity, problems with concentration or attention, motor restlessness, alternating with sleepiness, then the youngster is probably getting enough sleep at night. If these symptoms are there, then the parents should question whether or not the sleep is adequate, even if there is a total sleep time of 8 to 10 hours, because there may be something that's disrupting their sleep at night.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned teenagers, Dr. Sheldon, need lots more sleep. And I wanted to ask you about everything you just were talking about in terms of teenagers and their sort of their social lives. How much do you think school activities play a role in limiting teenager sleep time?
Well, I think school activities are essential, and their homework is essential. They need to do it. It's part of their normal growth and development, socialization. It's extremely important for them. But being overscheduled is the one thing that we need to be careful of, because they may move from one activity to another, doing 4 or 5 different activities after school, and then really don't get down to their homework until late at night. Then they expose themselves to bright light by doing much of their work on the computer or other screens that are required. And the bright light, especially blue light, which is the main source of light from LEDs that are used in computer screens, result in delaying the ability to fall asleep, so it delays their sleep phase. So it's a combination of factors. It's not just one thing. They're a combination of factors that really end up being a perfect storm.
Well, and then there's also the factor of what time they have to wake up for school start times. And I wanted to ask you about, is there evidence to suggest that schools delaying start times for the older the student gets, that that's beneficial?
There is much literature now, studies that have been done in Kentucky and North Carolina and Minnesota, where delaying school start time by just 1 hour is extremely beneficial for almost every aspect of the teenager's life. They have less tardiness. They do better in school performance, especially in the early morning classes. There's less illness, less accidents, especially automobile accidents, when the school start time is just delayed an hour.
Well, there's a few districts in Illinois that have followed this advice and made changes to school start times for older students. And when school started recently at McLean County, Unit 5 School District in the Bloomington Normal area was the second year of earlier starts for high school and junior high students. Mark Daniel is a superintendent of Unit 5, and he's joining us now as well. Superintendent, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Superintendent, so just last year you all made the switch. What time does junior high students start? What time do high schoolers start?
Well, our old schedule, we had high school starting at 7:15. Now it's 8:30. And junior high is from the old schedule was 7:45 to 3 o'clock, and now it begins at 8:45 and finishes at 3:45. So those were definitely a full hour swings. And our informal survey, and we did survey our parents and students as well as our staff, has indicated very positive benefits for our high school and junior high students.
What was the rationale? Yeah.
Elementary.
Yeah. What was the rationale behind the change originally? Was it the whole idea of looking at this research and knowing that what Dr. Sheldon was just talking about in terms of even auto accidents go down when they look at places where students can start later? Was that the rationale?
There were several factors. As you know, in the state of Illinois, transportation and the funding of transportation's been an issue for the past 8+ years because of proration. We were basically running into a fiscal imbalance. We had a structural deficit that had to be remedied. So we took an approach with the committee beginning in October of the school year, I believe 2015, and said, let's look at our entire transportation process. And four major goals came out of that. First of all, yes, we need to make it affordable. Second of all, though, timeliness, as well as safety, and then also how does it improve learning? And as Dr. Sheldon has mentioned, much research is out there now that's indicating, in fact, it does improve academic achievement of students, especially our high school and middle school students, because of their cycles. And we examined that research. And so therefore, our final conclusion and recommendation to our school board was to modify our school start times. And I'm glad that we did so. We really handled most of those pieces. Even though we had a rough start in regards just to the new schedule beginning of last year, a part of that was because of just transportation logistics itself. But I think at the end of the year, as things were beginning to be fine-tuned, definitely as I look at the survey information, people for the most part, and you're never going to have 100%, of course, but people for the most part are indicating that it is beneficial for our kids.
It's been beneficial for the kids. And has the school district also saved money then on the busing and transportation side?
We did because we were able to. The most efficient routing begins with our elementary students. We have roughly 16 elementary schools spread out throughout the community. We cover almost 214 square miles, a rather large geographic area. And so if you can distribute your fleet out among all those start points, you're in better locations then to start the second tier. We'll call the first tier being elementary and the second tier being the secondary students. So we were able to reduce buses, we were able to reduce routes, and we did some, we also repurchased some of our buses. But again, efficiency drove that, and we did roughly find about $1.1 million of savings.
Wow. So financial savings, and generally it sounds like you've gotten really positive feedback from parents and teachers. Dr. Sheldon, I want to bring you back in and ask, some people might hear about school starting later and assume if teenagers know they're going to start school later, won't they just be more likely to stay up later and then miss out on the potential for extra sleep?
Well, I don't think that that's been proven in any of the studies that have been done. They typically will get into bed about the same time and get about at least 15 to 45 minutes more sleep on an average when the school start time has been delayed. It is essential that they maintain their wake-up time, and the wake-up time is the most important time to reset our biological clock every day. And so that typically, the bedtime follows the wake-up time, and so they're getting into bed about the same time or just a little bit later, not very much.
Superintendent Daniel, do you have a sense that students seem better rested? I wonder what your attendance looked like last year, particularly for your upper-level schools.
What we looked at, we did look at attendance. We did look at tardiness. As you can imagine, our elementary students, their tardiness increased, and our high school students' tardiness decreased.
Okay, right.
And I'll just tell you, that's an indicator of, and we're literally transporting most of our elementary students. So you do still have some parents that quite weren't into the cycle, and we're hoping to see that improve. Overall attendance, very similar, so I really didn't see a difference in attendance. But if I go to, for instance, the survey for our high school students, and we asked them very simple questions, you know, was it a positive impact on your academics? And over 73% of our students said it was a positive impact. Then we go to our teachers. So a positive impact then with the later start time for high school students, this is by our high school staff members, it increased to 61% said it was positive. 18% were neutral, and then only 15% said it was a non-positive or did not have a positive impact. And that's rather significant.
And that's your staff.
Staff. So those would be teachers. But we saw that in very similar numbers, whether it be a student, whether it be a parent, or whether it be a high school teacher. So we feel very confident that that was the right decision, and we're moving forward and we'll continue with this schedule.
That sounds great. Dr. Sheldon, we just have a minute or two left for parents who are listening throughout the state who do not have the changes that have happened with in McLean County. We have some folks who are in that listening area, but people all over who maybe don't have this change start time. What do you recommend for parents to get their kids back into a regular sleep routine? What's the best thing to do?
Well, from the summer, they should gradually make the wake time earlier. And then keep the wake time fairly stable once it gets to the time when they would have to be waking up to go to school. It has to be slowly. You can't just do one big jump earlier. So if the youngsters are waking up at 10 o'clock, you can't automatically have them wake up at 7 or 7:30. But if you gradually move that back by a half hour over a two-week period of time, it's much easier for them to adapt, and they will be falling asleep earlier and earlier, and then keeping the schedule stable. I think there are other countermeasures that are important. I think it's important for schools perhaps to think about developing nap rooms. Young people who are sleepy, if they take a brief nap, like 5 or 10 minutes, they get two to three hours of refractory alertness after a very, very brief nap. I think we also have to start looking at lighting in the schools, especially in the morning, scheduling standardized tests and difficult classes rather than first thing in the morning, later in the morning, or in the mid-afternoon. So there is much about circadian rhythmicity that we can apply to schools, and I think that it would be very beneficial for parents and young people, as well as the school personnel. And I would like to compliment Superintendent on changing those school start times.
Yeah. Superintendent Daniel, maybe next change might be nap rooms in Unified Schools. Sounds like all right. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, thank you both for joining me. Superintendent Mark Daniel, McLean County Unit 5 School District, and Dr. Stephen Sheldon, who directs the Sleep Medicine Center at Lurie Children's Hospital. He's also a professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Both of you, thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.